Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's Monday, September 27th, and I always forget to use this little device. It might save my voice a little bit. Is it working? It's a little loud. Turn the volume way down. Pretty sensitive. Okay, so Bio 231, Monday, 27th. How's this? Does that help? I think that helps for you guys in the back that are horsing around all the time. Can hear me? I can, oh, that's even better. That's good. Is that annoying to anybody? Is that too loud? Not too loud, good, okay. I can use more of a normal voice if we do that. All right, so we're moving, oh, that is too loud. So we're moving out of bones and joints into muscle. And what we looked at last time, one of the last things we looked at last time was the knee joint. And remember, the knee joint, you have to know some ligaments. What's the definition of a ligament? Bone-to-bone connection, and then you had to learn a new kind of connection, which was a muscle-to-a-bone connection. What's that called? That's a tendon, right? So a ligament is really part of the skeletal system, but a tendon is really part of the muscle system. So we're going to move on to muscle system. All right, so what the heck is muscle good for? All right, let's talk about some functions. Of course, we all know that muscle is important for movement. And a muscle usually is attached to one bone on one end, and it's attached to another bone on the other end. And when that muscle gets excited, guess what happens to it? It shortens or contracts, pulling the two bones together, right? So it's used for articulations, to angulate different kinds of bones together. So movement is a real important function of muscle. But even though you're not moving, muscles are contracted. You're really not moving right now, but you have numerous muscles contracted because you're able to sit up straight in the chair without falling on the floor, banging your head on the tabletop and then the chair and then on the floor, right? So muscle is also important for posture, right? So just keeping your head erect. And a part of that, another concept that goes along with that, is joint stabilization. So again, even though you're not moving, muscles are contracted to protect various joints so that you don't have a joint that hyperextends that's not designed to hyperextend. You have antagonistic muscles in your neck right now that are working to maintain your head position. So joint stabilization is a very important function of muscles. And then lastly, generation of body heat. Because right now, what do you think the temperature in the room is? Cold, hot, but I would like a number, for instance. Take a guess. 70-something, maybe. Okay. Maybe it's a little warm because I'm running around, so maybe like 75 to 77 degrees, something like that. And what is your body temperature? Is it the same? No. You're a lot what? You're a lot warmer than room temperature, at least our room temperature. You're up at 98.6, right? So that's a very important homeostatic control feature, and so you need muscles to maintain your body temperature, to keep all your chemical reactions working properly. All right, so those are some important functions of muscle. Let's talk about some characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other kinds of tissues, right? First, we said that muscle is specialized to shorten or contract. That is true, but muscle is excitable. That means that it is relaxed unless it is told to contract. And as a matter of fact, what tells your muscles to contract? Your involuntary systems or your voluntary systems? Your conscious thought or your unconscious control? Yeah, your conscious thought controls skeletal muscle. You have other kinds of muscle that's controlled unconsciously. That's your cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. But skeletal muscle is controlled voluntarily by you. All right? And why do we call it skeletal muscle? Because what is it attached to? Your skeleton. Okay, so that's why we call it skeletal muscle. Okay. The other interesting thing about muscle is that not only can it contract and generate a lot of tension when it contracts, but it is also extensible. That means muscle can stretch. And that's going to be really important. For instance, probably the most important concept in physiology and anatomy is that of antagonism. All right, so for instance, if you have a biceps muscle in your anterior arm, when it contracts, right, there is a muscle that has to relax and stretch, and that is the triceps muscle. All right, and that's in balance with the biceps. So when the triceps contracts, right, the biceps relaxes, but what else does it have to do? It's got to stretch back out. Okay, so extensibility is an important feature of skeletal muscle. And the last one is elasticity, which means what? That when you stretch something out and let go, what happens to it? Does it stay the same length? No, it goes back to its resting length. So if you overstretch a muscle and let go, then it will go back to its resting length. And a very important function in your body uses that elastic property of skeletal muscle, and that is in the respiratory system. As a matter of fact, most of the reason why we exhale is because of the elastic properties of muscles and the lung tissue itself. So that's a very important property. Don't forget, there are three kinds. You should know what they look like underneath the microscope, what some of their characteristics are, and some of their structural characteristics, right? That's skeletal, cardiac, and smooth muscle. Okay, and skeletal and smooth sometimes we call fibers because they're long and narrow kinds of cells. But cardiac muscle tissue, we usually don't call that a fiber because why? They're not long and narrow. What are they? They're short and branched as well. They're branched. All right, so let's focus our attention on skeletal muscle and look at some general characteristics of skeletal muscle, just like we looked at a general model of bone. What do we use to understand how a general bone is put together? A long bone, that's right, because we saw the spongy bone and cortical bone, right, and osteons and all that kind of stuff. All right, so I want you to think of skeletal muscle with each of these kinds of features, right? And this is probably an important exam figure as well. Where's it going? Oh, it's way over here. Okay, I can grab it. I think I can grab it. Oh, good. We got it. Okay, so here is a pretty good illustration of some parts of a muscle, at least the gross anatomy. And when we say gross anatomy, what do we mean? Yeah, you can see with your naked eye. There's some things that we need to see with a microscope, like here's a nucleus, we would need a microscope. So there's a little artistic license on this slide, but we're going to even look at some finer detail within a muscle cell. All right, so here we have a bone. Oh, who can tell me what bone that is? Yeah, nice femur, okay. And here is the muscle, and it's connected to bone via this tendon, right, is dense regular connective tissue surrounding the whole muscle right here. Remember, that's a nice organ because it's got nerves and it's got blood vessels and other kinds of connective tissues in it. There's a connective tissue that surrounds the whole organ, right, and that's what we call the epimysium. Epi means on top of the whole muscle, right? But if we look at that whole muscle deep to the epimysium, we see that there are a bunch of different bundles that make up this muscle right here. And indeed, sometimes we call them bundles. At other times, we call those fascicles. So a muscle is broken down into fascicles. And surrounding every fascicle that separates them out is the perimysium. Okay, peri meaning surrounding every muscle bundle. All right, so let's pull out one of the fascicles, which we have right here. All right, or a fascicle. And look, there's even some fine structure that makes up a fascicle. Right, so here is a structure that's making up a fascicle, and there's connective tissue that separates this structure out from all of these other structures that make up a fascicle, and that's what we call the endomysium. All right, so epi is around the connective tissue around the whole organ, perimysium is around the fascicle, and this endomysium is actually surrounding every cell, or what's another name for a skeletal muscle cell? A fiber. Right, so the connective tissue around every fiber is what we call the endomysium. And as these things merge to either one end or the other of the muscle, all of these different connective tissues merge together and attach to this tendon so that they're all pulling together when this muscle contracts. All right, so here we have a muscle. We see some fine structure in a muscle we call the fascicle. And if we look at a fascicle, we see structures inside of it that we call fibers. And then if we pull out one muscle fiber, which is a cell, what do we see? Even some more structures, right, based on these long tubes, all right? So we want to look at these things as well. Well, every muscle cell is very, very long and has many nuclei. Like I see one, two nuclei on this illustration right here. But a muscle cell could have even hundreds of nuclei. And the reason why is because during development, numerous muscle cells, progenitor cells, form, fuse together to form this one muscle fiber. And so all of those nuclei that were in separate cells after fusion end up in this one muscle fiber. Okay, so we can see, oh, some blood vessels. Let me see. I do want to talk about that, but I think I want to talk about this structure first, right here. All right, so this is a muscle cell or a muscle fiber, and this is the cell membrane that's around that muscle cell, and there's going to be a connective tissue. Anybody remember what the connective tissue sheath that is around every muscle fiber called? On the outside, it's the peri, okay? And then this right here is the endomysium that's around. Well, it's not shown on this particular slide. Then deep to the endomysium is the cell membrane, but for a muscle cell, we call that the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear this term sarco, you should think of a muscle cell. Like the cytoplasm inside of a skeletal muscle cell is not called cytoplasm, it's called the sarcoplasm because it's part of the muscle cell. All right, so here are some of the fine structures that we see inside the cell, a number of nuclei. All right, and it takes energy for this muscle cell to contract, and so I would expect to see mitochondria, and maybe these things right here, oh yes, labeled are mitochondria. What's the job of these mitochondria? Producing a lot of ATP, right? And these tubes right here are organelles inside the cell. They're called myofibrils. These are the organelles that actually shorten or contract. And if we look inside of a myofibril, look what we see. More structure. Or if we look at the side of a myofibril, we can see even some structures inside the myofibril. Now we're getting really, really small. I don't think in lab we've even seen a myofibril with a light microscope because it's way too small. And certainly we would not be able to see some of these other molecules or proteins that make up a myofibril, but we're really interested in them. All right. Oh, I do want to go back. Now, when you look at the fine structure within a myofibril, can you see there's a repeating pattern? You have a dark band and a light band, a dark band and a light band, and all of these bands within myofibrils within one cell all line up exactly right, right on top of each other. And if we were to put another muscle cell above this one, guess what? All of these striations, these are what we call striations, would line up perfectly as well. So when we look at skeletal muscle, it doesn't look homogeneous. It looks like it has these stripes in it because indeed it really does. So let's find out what produces that stripe pattern. It's a pattern that allows this muscle cell to contract. And that's what we see right here. So here we have a myofibril. Where does this fit in with that scheme that we've just been talking about? What is a myofibril? It's an organelle, that's right. And we put a bunch of these together, right? If we put a bunch of myofibrils together, what do we get? We get a muscle cell or muscle fiber. Put a bunch of myofibrils, what I have on the screen, put a bunch of those together, we get a fiber, right? And if we put a bunch of fibers together, we get a, that's when we get a fascicle. And then when we put a bunch of fascicles together, that's when we get the whole muscle, right? So I do want you to appreciate that organization, that hierarchical organization. Start with the big, end up with the small, or start with the small and end up with the big. So let's start with the big thing and work our way back down. The big thing is the muscle, right? It's that organ. And when we look at it, we see it's made up of fascicles, and every fascicle is made up of fibers, and within a fiber, which is a cell, right, inside that cell, we have organelles that we call myofibrils, right? And so here we see a myofibril with this real fancy pattern. We have to now know what makes up this pattern, and those are what we call myofilaments. So myofibrils are made up of myofilaments, and we have to know a couple different kinds of myofilaments. There are some that are real thick, like where I have the cursor right now. That's what we call a myosin molecule. And then there's some that are relatively thin, and that's what we call actin. So sometimes we call these thick filaments and thin filaments. Myosin is the thick, and actin is the thin one. There's some other proteins that we'll talk about in just a little bit. All right, but this is the unit that repeats itself over and over and over again, thousands of times from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. And when I say fiber, what does that mean? That means a muscle cell, right, from one end of the muscle cell to the other. This is the unit that I really want you to know something about, okay? You see the zigzag line right here? That's what we call a Z-disc, and then I see another zigzag line right over here. There's another Z-disc. That's the beginning and the end of the structural and functional unit of contraction within both cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle. All right, so remember we talked about structural and functional unit before. We talked about the structural and functional unit of life. What's that? That's a cell. What's the structural and functional unit of compact bone? Osteon, right? Which is kind of a complicated thing, but if you understand that complicated thing, then that model works really well. All right, so the structural and functional unit of contraction is this thing right here from one Z disc to the other, and that's what we call the sarcomere. So we got to know something about the sarcomere. There's something that's going to bring these Z discs together when we excite the muscle, all right? And it's going to be an interaction between actin, which is what kind of filament? The thin one, and myosin, which is the thick one. Okay. I think maybe I want to go over that organization one more time. If we put a bunch of myofilaments together, like actin and myosin, what do we get? We get the myofibril, right? And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a fiber. Put a bunch of fibers together, we get a fascicle, right? And put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the muscle, right? I think you guys are doing pretty good. All right, so let's get back to this sarcomere. So it has different bands. Because the myosin is really thick, right, it has a tendency to block a lot of light as you shine light through it through a microscope, especially polarized light. And so we call that dark band the A band. Right, so here's the A band, which just makes up where we find the myosin. And since actin is really thin, where we see just actin right here, right, we call that the I band. And that might seem pretty complicated to remember, but this dark band right here has what vowel in it? A. So that's pretty easy to remember. That's not how it was named, really, all right? But that works for a test. And the I band, all right, we call that a light band because why? It's got an I in it. That's an easy way to remember it. It has to do with how light was polarized when it went through these bands. Isotropic versus anisotropic, but you don't have to know that, right? The dark band is the A band, the light band is the I band, okay? Then the Z discs are the ends of the sarcomere. And what attaches to the end of a sarcomere? What attaches to the Z disc? What myofilament do you see attaching right there? Okay, here's the Z disc, right where I have the cursor. What myofilament is attaching to the Z disc? It is the actin, yeah, it's the thin filament, right? Not the myosin. Myosin is kind of in the middle of the sarcomere. It's attached to some proteins right here that we call the M line. Don't know, oh yeah, you got to know that. Here's the M line. This is probably an exam figure, right? So M line, why is that M line easy to remember? Because M for middle, right? Sort of like metaphase, M for midline, in the middle of the sarcomere. And where we don't have any overlap of actin, right, it looks a little bit lighter in this region right here. We just call that the H zone. All right, so this is the structure of a myofilament. Okay, now what does this really look like? Okay, I'm going to introduce a couple other little proteins for you. Here is a sarcomere from one Z disc to the other. Attached to the Z disc is that thin filament. Notice myosin isn't really attached to it, but there is a molecule that its presence allows for the elasticity in skeletal muscle, and that's this little spring guy right here. Kind of looks like a spring, and that's what we call a titin molecule. All right, so that's titin. Oh yeah, that's good. Titin, that's the elastic. This thing doesn't contract, but when it stretches, what does it do? It brings the muscle back to its resting length. Okay, and so it helps position the myosin right in the middle of the sarcomere. All right, and so can you see the myosin is the thick filament? Absolutely, and the thin is the actin. And also on the myosin, we have these like fingers poking out of it, kind of gives it a really rough edge. All right, so these are what we call myosin head groups, and I'll describe what happens to them in a second, but I want to ask you guys a question. Since what's the first function of muscle that we mentioned? What does it do? Contraction. It actually shortens. So a good question would be, and so we now know all the proteins that make up a sarcomere. The sarcomere shortens, all of the sarcomeres shorten when a muscle contracts. Could you guess which one of these myofilaments or proteins actually shortens when a muscle contracts? Would it be a thin filament, actin? Could it be this thick filament right here, myosin? Okay. Or maybe both of them. It could be maybe both of them. So that's something that we have to investigate and see what happens. All right, so, wow, this is a really nice figure of a sarcomere. What's a sarcomere again? It is a structural and functional unit of contraction, okay, in skeletal and cardiac muscle. Oh, excuse me a second. Okay, and don't forget, a sarcomere is not from here to here. Where's a sarcomere? It's from Z-disc to Z-disc. So I almost don't like where these arrows are on this figure right here. All right, it goes from one Z-disc to the other, all the way across. Okay. Well, this is what this is an electron micrograph of a sarcomere. Okay. And so this right here is one end, and then over here is the other end. So this is a sarcomere from Z-disc to Z-disc. And this dark area, what's this band, this dark area right here? That's the A band. And then on either side of the Z disc, where we only have actin and no myosin, this is the I band because it's lighter, right? And then here's the M line within the H zone. Okay, so we can see some of these different filaments, like the thick filaments are in this region and the thin filaments are over here. Oh, and then we can see these nice mitochondria as well. Okay. All right, so how does this system work? Where's the picture I want to get to? Okay, let's make this kind of comparison. Here is a muscle at rest, not contracting. And you see all the typical bands, the light band, right, and the dark band, all that kind of stuff. Now, in your mind, try to remember the distance from the end of the myosin to the other end of the myosin, right, and the length of this actin right here, but after it contracts, right, so after the muscle contracts, right, so it's contracted, could you tell that the Z discs are actually closer together? Let's go back. Try to memorize this distance from Z to Z, as opposed from Z to Z over here. Can you see this first condition? The distance from Z to Z is a lot longer than the second condition from here to here. I wish I had two screens, but I can't get the other one working. All right, the next thing that I want you to look at is look at the length of a myosin on this slide versus this one right here. Does it look like it got any shorter? Is this one shorter or this one shorter? It looks the same. Okay, if I was able to go up there with a ruler and measure it, the myosin is the same length from here to here, as opposed to when it's fully relaxed. It's the same length. All right, so let's investigate what the length of the actin molecule is. All right, the actin is the one attached to a Z disc. So here is an actin. Let's look on the next slide. From here to here. Is it obviously a lot shorter? Let's flip back. Here versus here. It looks like it's the same length as well. Okay? All right, so when a sarcomere contracts, the myosin doesn't shorten, and neither does the actin. So how would you explain how these Z discs are actually coming together? Okay, look at the overlap. When the muscle is contracted, okay, notice that these actin molecules, the one on the left and the one on the right, are pulled together and they're almost touching. And as a matter of fact, they might even be overlapping at some point in time. And if you look at the myosin and across from myosin to actin, there is no part of this myosin where there isn't an actin molecule, right? There's no space. But if we look at a relaxed muscle, look at this whole part of the myosin. There's no actin for it to associate with, and the ends of these actins are far apart. All right, so the reason why a sarcomere contracts is what there's a model that we have in our mind that's called the sliding filament mechanism or model. Because what are these things again? Are these muscle fibers? Are these myofibrils? Or what are these? These are myofilaments, right? So we use the sliding filament model to show how a sarcomere contracts. So if my fingers represent actin and myosin and my wrists are the Z discs, when a muscle is told to contract, guess what happens? The actin and myosin slide over each other, right? So none of my fingers are any shorter, right? The myosin and actin aren't shorter at all, but since they slide over each other, my wrists are brought together. Okay, so a sarcomere contracts because these filaments will slide over each other. That's the important concept, and we call that the sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. Right? And the reason why that happens is because when a nerve impulse reaches a muscle cell, there's a chain of events that causes these head groups to bind to the actin. Right? So here's a head group on myosin. It can bind to actin, and then these things flex, and it pulls the actin molecule over the myosin. And when that happens, it pulls the Z discs closer together. All right, so there is an association only when this muscle gets stimulated. And what causes this little myosin head group to flex, all right, and then release and grab hold again is an ATP molecule. So that requires ATP. All right, and muscles are very, very strong because, let's go way back over here. Because if we can look at a three-dimensional picture of this myosin right here, what is surrounding every myosin molecule? Just like these head groups are poking out in all different directions, what is surrounding every myosin molecule? If we look at this diagram right here, so if we take a myofibril and make a nice transverse cut at the level of the I-band or H-zone or M-line, here we see, and let's look at the outer edge of the A-band, where there's both actin and myosin. So here is a thick filament. What do we call a thick filament again? Myosin, and here's a thin filament we call actin. Remember, there are head groups that are poking out in all different directions from this myosin right here. But what protein is completely surrounding every myosin molecule? It's completely surrounded by actin, right? And every actin molecule is surrounded by myosin, right? So it's a very intricate and interesting arrangement. So there is plenty of association via these head groups between actin and myosin. So these sarcomeres can develop a lot of tension when they're told to contract and pull on each other so that when they slide over each other, the two ends of the muscles come together. Okay, so let me go back to this diagram right here. There's a signal that allows myosin to associate with actin right here and to cause them to slide over each other. And that's an ion that gets released within the muscle cell, and that ion is calcium. All right, so we're going to see where calcium comes from. There's just a calcium ion that floods this muscle cell that causes the sliding of actin and myosin filaments together. Now, Where else have you learned that calcium is important in your body? Here's the sign-in sheet. Bones, right? For making bones really strong. But where else do you have to have the proper levels of calcium in your body? Within muscles so that they can contract, all right? So as we get older and our body has a harder time holding on to calcium and absorbing calcium from our diet, if you had a choice, where would you put the priority for putting calcium? In muscles so that they can contract? What do you use a muscle for all the time? Breathing, for instance, right? That's a very important muscle, your diaphragm. Or would you prefer to have strong bones? Would you prefer to have muscles that contract or strong bones? Yeah, and guess what? Everybody's body makes that same decision too as we get older. And that's one of the reasons why osteoporosis happens in people, because there are more important areas in your body for calcium than just bones. Okay, so let's take a look and see something, another model that we want to look at. Let's look at this structure right here. All right, so I see a number of sarcomeres, right, from Z-disc to Z-disc. And so here's a myofibril. If we put a whole bunch of myofibrils together, what do we get? This whole big structure right here. That's the cell or the fiber, right? And so here are all the organelles. And so here is the cell membrane that we call the sarcolemma. The surface of a muscle cell acts a lot like a nerve cell. It can conduct electrical impulses over the sarcolemma or the cell membrane. So for instance, when this muscle cell gets stimulated or gets told to contract, it receives an electrical signal from a nerve. That electrical signal flows over the whole outside of the muscle fiber. All right, but here are the myofibrils deep inside the cell. And you're probably wondering, well, how does that electrical signal get into the deep parts of the muscle fiber right here to tell all these sarcomeres to contract? Well, there are some of these little tubes that go from the surface of the cell all the way to the interior-most regions of the fiber. And since they move in a transverse direction, we call these T-tubules or transverse tubules. They carry electrical signals from the surface of the cell deep to the inside of the muscle fiber. All right, and when that electrical signal passes by the smooth endoplasmic reticulum with inside the cell, see, here's endoplasmic reticulum, but do you see any ribosomes on it? This blue right here, is that blue or is it purple?
Blue.
Blue, very good. Okay, so this blue right here, okay, that smooth endoplasmic reticulum, because you don't see any ribosomes on it, the job of this endoplasmic reticulum in a muscle cell is not necessarily just to make lipids, but it also is a reservoir for calcium. It stores calcium. So when the electrical signal moves over this T-tubule, it causes the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is really smooth ER. That calcium then rushes out, it surrounds all the myofilaments, and it causes cross bridges to form between the head groups of myosin and the actin molecule. And when that happens, what happens to the filaments? They slide over each other, and when they slide over each other, the Z-discs are brought together. And that happens with all the thousands of sarcomeres that are lined up on one end to the other, and all the thousands of myofibrils within all the various muscle cells, and that muscle contracts. All right, the only other thing you got to remember is that ATP is necessary for that cycling of cross bridges, and that comes from the mitochondria. The other thing that I see on this diagram is sometimes a T-tubule where it runs right up against this terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Sometimes if we think of both terminal cisternae along with the T-tubule right here, we call that a triad. All right, so this is a pretty important exam figure because it has all of the parts of the sarcomere. The myofilaments aren't labeled on this one, but we will label it in a second. And it shows other organelles inside the fiber, namely the T-tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum and mitochondria. So what's the job of this sarcoplasmic reticulum? You should know that. You should be able to verbalize that today. When the muscle's at rest, it's storing something, and that is? Calcium, when a muscle gets stimulated, right, because muscle is excitable, the sarcoplasmic reticulum releases that calcium, okay, and that causes the filaments to slide over each other, right? And then the Z-discs come together and that causes muscle contraction, okay? So that's what we call excitation-contraction coupling, the understanding of how these different molecular events actually cause shortening of the sarcomere. All right, I'm going to have to... All right, so we talked about this stuff. Oh, this is really nice, the description right here. Okay, the T-tubules. All right. Let's look at the neuromuscular junction. And then we're going to go back to talking about some gross anatomy. All right, so the neuromuscular junction, what does that look like? Here is a nerve coming from your central nervous system going out to your periphery to a skeletal muscle. And these are the tips of the nerve. So here is a long axon. Oh, that's right. In histology, you had to know something about a neuron. It had three main areas. It had the cell body. And then it had some little projections, little processes poking out, and one really long projection. What were the short ones called? Those are the dendrites. And the really long one is the axon. So here's an axon, the really long projection, and it's ending up right on this muscle fiber. So here is a axon terminal, and you can see that there's a little swelling right here, right? And so sometimes we call that a little terminal button or Bouton terminale, or goes by a bunch of different names. There's a bunch of machinery inside this little swelling right here. And when the nerve impulse reaches this end right here, right, that electrical signal can't jump right into this muscle. It's converted into a chemical signal. Right, so the nerve is going to communicate with the muscle cell right here through what we call a synapse. And so here's another structural and functional unit I want you to be aware of. And that is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So this nerve cell is going to communicate with the muscle cell through a synapse, and in particular, a chemical synapse. And here is the chemical synapse right here. A little bit of an enlarged view. All right, so here is the end of the axon. And then here is the sarcolemma, the cell membrane of the muscle cell. And there's a big space between them. We call that the synaptic cleft. So since there's a space right here, that electrical signal can't go directly from the nerve into the muscle. Right? But this is how the communication goes. As the electrical signal comes down the axon, it flows over this little swelling at the end of the axon, and we see various vesicles inside the axon, and it's filled with what we call neurotransmitter. It's a chemical, right? So we call these synaptic vesicles with neurotransmitter. These vesicles fuse with this, what we call the presynaptic membrane of the nerve cell, and it exocytoses neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, and then it moves across the cleft and it bumps into the cell membrane of the muscle cell, and there are receptors for that particular chemical compound that bind the neurotransmitter, and when that happens, it causes another electrical signal to develop on the membrane of the muscle cell. And that electrical signal flows over the whole muscle cell, right, and even down the T-tubules, and then that's going to cause the release of calcium, causing myofilaments to slide over each other. So notice that there is an electrical signal over the cell membrane of the nerve, and there's an electrical signal over the cell membrane of the muscle cell. So in that respect, nerve cells and muscle cells are very similar, right, because they can conduct electrical signals. And have you ever touched an electrical cord by accident? You got an electrical shock? What happened to your muscles? They jump, right? Because that electrical signal, right, can stimulate these muscles and cause the release of calcium, right, from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and cause those muscles to contract. That was, right, kind of an abnormal signal. Usually that electrical signal comes from the nerve right here. Okay. So, when we talk about a chemical synapse, the signal that is coming down a nerve, is what kind of signal? Is it electrical or chemical? If you're going to pick one or the other, coming down a nerve. It is, think of it as an electrical signal, okay? And that electrical signal has to be converted into a chemical signal that goes across the synapse, and when it does, that signal then is converted back to an electrical signal that flows over the muscle. All right, so that is the general scheme that I want you to know for a chemical synapse. All right, in the nerve, it's electrical. Across the synapse, it gets converted into a chemical signal that we call a neurotransmitter, and then it gets converted back to an electrical signal back on the surface of the muscle cell. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical through this kind of synapses, which is what we call a chemical synapse, because through the synapse, the information is carried by a neurotransmitter. And for skeletal muscle, there is only one neurotransmitter that's used everywhere in your body, and that is acetylcholine. And sometimes we abbreviate that ACH. ACH is acetylcholine. And I'm sure that's in your notes. Okay, acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter that is stored by all of these synaptic vesicles. So what else? So this junction right here, this chemical synapse, right, between the nerve and a skeletal muscle is sometimes what we call a neuromuscular junction. And the neuromuscular junction is going to be a good model of a way to think about how even two neurons communicate with each other through a chemical synapse. And when we get to the nervous system, you'll see that it's the same kind of scheme. The only difference is that in the neuromuscular junction, there are other special proteins that help attach this axon terminus to the muscle, right? Because they have to stay connected right at this area right here. And what would dislocate this terminal button from a muscle? When this muscle gets stimulated, there has to be special proteins that anchor this bouton, right, this little button right here to the skeletal muscle cell, because when the muscle is told to contract, what happens? It's going to move, right? And so there's got to be some special glue between this nerve fiber and the muscle cell that keep it attached. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to use that muscle again if it rips off. All right, so here is a good illustration of the neuromuscular junction, which is a chemical synapse. All right, who wants me to go over some more stuff regarding those pictures right there? What is this one? That's just what we were looking at before, right? It's just a neuromuscular junction. And the space between the nerve and the muscle, that's what we call the cleft, synaptic cleft. How does information get across the synaptic cleft in the neuromuscular junction? As what kind of signal? The chemical signal, right? A general name would be a neurotransmitter because it's released by this nerve. A specific name for the neuromuscular junction is acetylcholine, or ACH, is the neurotransmitter that this neuron produces. Okay, here's this calcium. What does this calcium do, this calcium ion? What does it cause? Yeah, the muscle to contract. How does the muscle contract? It's the sliding of the filaments, right? The myosin and actin filaments only slide over each other when there's this calcium signal. And that's stored in the sarcoplasmic reticulum right here. Only when there's a nerve impulse or an electrical impulse going through the T-tubule does it cause release of calcium. Okay. All right, let's talk about some other kinds of gross anatomy of a muscle. Okay, so you might be familiar with some of these things already. I see a bone right here. What bone does that look like to you? That's a nice humerus. All right, then we got some bones right here in the, what part of your body is this? Forearm. We got two bones, the radius and the ulna. All right, so here I see an ulna. And is this the medial or lateral bone? Aha, tricked you. That's the medial bone, because which is the lateral? The radius, right? So we're actually looking at the inside of somebody's arm, looking out away from their body, not looking in. So it just the way it goes, right? So here's the ulna. How do I know this is the ulna? Does it say? It doesn't say. Yeah, because here's the head, nice and round over here. Here is the olecranon process, right? The coronoid process with the trochlear notch. So for sure, that's a nice ulna. And ulna, you just got to know is medial. Then here's the radius. Here is a muscle. And it connects between the humerus and this tubercle on the ulna. And we call that the brachialis muscle. And most muscles have two ends. And the brachialis is a really good example. Here's one end up over here. It's a little bit of a broad attachment to the humerus. And this one down over here is a little bit more narrow. And what do we call a muscle-to-bone connection? A nice tendon, right? Okay, and when this muscle contracts, right, the humerus really doesn't move. It's the bones of the forearm that move together, especially the ulna. And what do we call this motion? Okay, we're decreasing the angle between the arm and forearm, so that's a nice flexion motion. All right, so a muscle has these two ends. One is called the origin, and the other is called the insertion. The more stationary end is the origin. The end of the muscle that's producing motion in the body is called the insertion. Right, so you just got to be familiar with that. In the appendages, usually the origin is superior and the insertion is inferior. And that's going to cause flexion in various joints of your appendages. Okay, so I do want you to know origin and insertion by, the motion that it produces. Okay, so origin is the less movable end, the insertion is the more movable end. Direct attachments, like we see with the brachialis to the humerus, the tendons are really short. All right, with an indirect attachment, tendons are relatively long, like the insertion of the brachialis. And even, you'll see for the biceps brachii as well. Okay. So we've kind of talked about all of this stuff already right here. Okay. I want to go over the motor unit, definition of motor unit. Go back one picture. Okay, so here we have an illustration that shows the spinal cord. And we see some nerves leaving the spinal cord going all the way to a muscle. And this could be, for instance, like the brachialis muscle connected to this bone via this tendon. And I see some compartments within the muscle. What are these compartments called? Could go by two different names. It could be called bundles. But the more proper term is fascicle, right? And within fascicles, you see individual muscle cells or muscle fibers. And notice that you have one nerve, right, going to each of these different cells. I don't see any cell anywhere that is that has more than one neuromuscular junction on it. This one has one, this one has one, this is one, this is one, this is one right here. Okay. All right, so muscles contract in an all or none response. Or muscle fibers contract in an all or none response. When a muscle is told to contract, it contracts with its full ability. Right? But you know that you can lift up something very light, for instance, like this rubber band right here, or I could lift up like a 100-gallon fish tank with my arm. Right? One is really light, one is really heavy. Right? So how is it that you can pick up something really light or something really heavy? If a skeletal muscle cell contracts with 100% of its potential all the time. And that's because, right, look at all of these fascicles within the muscle and all of these different muscle cells. What happens is that when you're picking up something light, only a few of these muscle fibers are contracting. All the rest remain relaxed. But as the object gets heavier and heavier and heavier, guess what happens? You recruit more and more muscle cells to contract, producing more tension so that you can lift up heavier and heavier weights. All right? And the reason why that is because different muscle cells are connected to different nerves. So, and in some parts of your body, the arrangement is quite a bit different. Notice this blue neuron right here goes to how many muscle cells? Only two. All right? And then we have this red neuron going to 3. All right? And so if we look at a motor neuron and all of the muscle cells that it innervates, we call that a motor unit. So we got motor unit number 1 that can contract 2 muscle fibers. Motor unit number 3 can contract 3 muscle fibers. All right? If we stimulate the blue neuron, is that going to produce a weaker or stronger connection compared to if we stimulate the red neuron? Weaker, right? 30% less. All right? But then if you want to pick up something heavier, you could switch to motor unit number 2. But if you're going to pick up something even heavier, what would you use? Motor 1, yeah, and motor unit number 2 all together. And then if it's really heavy, what are you going to do? You're going to recruit all of these muscle fibers right here and in all of these fascicles to produce a maximal contraction to lift up something really, really heavy. We call that recruitment. All right, so even though a muscle fiber and an individual cell will contract to 100% of its ability, the whole muscle won't do that unless, right, you tell it to do that. Okay, and a lot of that just has to do with experience. Have you ever picked up something that was really light that you thought was heavy? Like what? One thing I can think of, it's not really all that heavy, but it's kind of heavy. But you ever go to a restaurant and they put a big mug, a glass mug filled with ice water in it, right? And you lift it up and you almost like throw it on who's ever sitting next to you because it's not a glass mug, it's really a plastic mug, okay? What is your mind? It's recruited too many muscle fibers for the job, but fortunately there's a part of your brain that figures that out really fast, usually, before you spill it. That's the cerebellum. When we get to the nervous system, we'll talk about that, okay? But that's just a mismatch of the number of motor units that were recruited to do the job. Okay, so know the good definition of a motor unit. It is what? One motor neuron and all of the individual muscle fibers that it innervates. So for instance, in your back, you might have a very large motor unit because you don't do a lot of things with your back muscles. They're just postural muscles. You might have one motor unit that goes to 1,000 individual muscle fibers, and they all contract together so that you sit up straight. Okay, but other parts of your body where you have very fine control, like facial muscles for breathing and articulation and your fingers, right, what we call the innervation ratio is very small. You might have one neuron going to just a couple muscle fibers where you have very fine discriminative control. So that's an important feature to know as well. Okay. You know, I'm not going to go over different kinds of skeletal muscle fibers, but there are different kinds of fibers. Some are slow, some are fast, some use different kinds of biochemistry. We're pretty much born with these different types, and we can't convert one type to another. So that kind of explains why some people are better at certain kinds of athletic events compared to other people because of the different kinds of muscle fibers that we have. Okay. Cardiac muscle. Ooh, I don't know if we have cardiac muscle in this chapter right here. Yeah, we've got a couple different kinds right here. Here is skeletal muscle. It's striated. Here's cardiac muscle. Okay, and you can tell this is cardiac muscle because of the branching pattern right here. The cells are short. Can anybody remember what these things are called? Yeah, intercalated discs right here. Okay, now skeletal muscle is kind of interesting because it doesn't have a chemical synapse, but nonetheless, all these cells do communicate with each other because electrical signals can pass from one cardiac muscle cell, okay, into the next through this intercalated disc right here. So there are special little conduits for electricity to move through that we call gap junctions. So there are gap junctions an intercalated disc, so that if one cardiac muscle cell is stimulated into contracting, what happens to all the other cardiac muscle cells? They get stimulated into contracting as well. And that makes perfect sense for the heart because in order for the heart to pump blood, it's got to contract as a unit, right? It's got to contract as a unit. The other reason why we see branching patterns right here is because when one cell is stimulated, not only are its neighbors right and left stimulated, But because of the branching patterns, where does that electrical signal go? It goes down to the next deeper layer, and then down into the next deeper layer. So not only does the tip of the heart and the base of the heart all get information, but even all of the different layers within the heart, the superficial layers and the deep layers. Right, so the whole wall thickness of the heart contracts as a unit because of that branching pattern of cardiac muscle cells. So electricity not only moves right to left, but it moves from superficial to deep through the whole wall of the heart muscle. Okay, and since you see striations right here, what do you think you have in cardiac muscle that you have in skeletal muscle? Because skeletal muscle has striations. What produces striations in skeletal muscle? The way actin and myosin line up because of the structure of a sarcomere, right? So cardiac muscle has pretty much the same arrangement. Cardiac muscle has sarcomeres as well, right? It has Z-discs and it has actin and myosin molecules. Now, when we get to smooth muscle over here, do you see striations? No, it doesn't really have sarcomeres. It has actin and myosin molecules that slide over each other, but the arrangement is a lot different. And I don't think I have time to talk about that in this class. We don't have time to talk about it. Okay? It has actin and myosin, but it doesn't have Z-discs. Maybe next time I'll bring a little model in class. Okay? And I can describe a little bit about smooth muscle, how it contracts. Actin and myosin still slide over each other, but it's more like a network rather than a parallel arrangement. Right, it's more like think of a net or a mesh that actin and myosin make. Okay. The other thing with this skeletal muscle cell, look at all of these nuclei. It means the skeletal muscle fiber is very long because it's put together with hundreds of individual stem cells to make this one muscle fiber. Okay. All right, so I think that's it for lecture for today. All right, I'd like to see the sign-in sheet. Thank you so much. Got it. All right, and I'm going to put the lectures on the website tonight.